Good to see everybody. I know it's been quite a long time since I've actually talked to most of you folks here, but I know you kind of saw what happened there in the draft room. What I kind of want to do is just kind of give you an idea of actually like what goes on in draft day, or what goes on in the draft room. Kind of talk to you about like exactly where we are in the process, like as of today, what we've kind of gone through, and then kind of work backwards, if you will, which that entails the All-Star Games, the Combine, you know, which I know everybody as a tender was there, and you know, and then even talk a little bit about the actual fall scouting process and kind of how we arrived to what you saw here, you know, on draft day. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen actually in the draft room on draft day. I would say just generally speaking, it's actually pretty tame for the most part during the course of the day, you know, because where we've picked here the past few years, we've been sort of towards the bottom of the round. So there's obviously a lot of time that's available during the day for us. So we kind of sit back. We really don't know when we're going to pick, if we're going to pick. So it's pretty tame. There's a little dialogue back and forth. I think some of the trade discussions, those usually pick up, I would say, between 5 to 8 picks out. You know, might start to get a few more calls. Now, up to that point, we've probably talked during the course of the week, either Coach Belichick or myself have talked to representatives from other clubs about potential possibilities, but they really don't manifest themselves actually until draft day. I would say, by and large, there aren't too many trades that are, at least from our perspective, that are agreed upon before we go into the draft room. Like, hey, we have this pick in this round, they have this pick, and we kind of agree to the deal. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but I'd say by and large, most of the discussions take place actually as you get closer to your pick. So we were at 22 originally, I believe. We moved back with Dallas. And there's a number of people that are involved in the process, as you can see. Whether it's myself talking to another team, Coach Belichick maybe talking to another team, Mr. Kraft actually was involved in the Dallas situation. So when we actually do consummate a trade, what we have to do is there's a couple of different parties that are involved. The league, there's a league representative that actually is in New York for the draft that we need to contact and tell them, look, we're trading the pick. And then that's when you start to have the runners. Each team has a runner. Like we have a runner, other team will have a runner, and the runner will stand behind. Like if Karen is one team and Mike's another team, you'll actually have the two runners stand behind those respective teams, because those are the teams that are dealing with the trade. So you have to communicate between ourselves and the other team, so in that case, Dallas, and then we have to notify the league office or the league representative that the trade is taking place, because there's just some logistical things, some paperwork things that just need to be taken care of before we move forward. So then when we got to the 24th pick, I'd say the same thing sort of happened. So there's a lot of people that are involved, and it's a short time period. You know, we're talking about 10 minutes in the first round. Then when you get to the second round, which with the Gronkowski pick, those things happened a little quicker. And, you know, you saw kind of the clock, I don't know, almost ran out, whatever the case may be, which is not too dissimilar to what happened a few years back. I want to say it was Minnesota and somebody else with that pick. So we were on the phone with Oakland, and we hadn't had confirmation. We thought we had a trade. We wanted to make sure, so we couldn't really pull the trigger. So that's why we were kind of like, all right, let's hold on here. Then we sort of had a scramble, and we told the runner to get moving as quickly as he could, and the trade ended up going through. So there are some moving parts. There's a lot of communication that has to take place, you know, in our building and then with other people in New York. But I'd say for the most part, when you're not picking, things are pretty quiet. You know, there's not many of us that are in the draft room, but there's discussions back and forth. We have the board, which we'll kind of get to here in a minute, kind of how that's put together. And we're just looking at the players and who might be available. So I'd say, and there's actually been even times where there's a wide gap from when we pick. Let's say we make a pick in the third round. We don't pick again until the fourth or fifth round. And maybe there's a few players that are on the board that we're looking at or considering. We might actually just throw some film on just to verify, okay, let's just make sure we know what we're looking at, what we're talking about here. So, and it's pretty relaxed, and the discussion is pretty free-flowing. And then when it's time to pick, then we make the pick, and then we move forward. So the days have been divided up here a little bit. Last year was, you know, the Thursday, Friday, Saturday schedule. We'll be on that same schedule here again this year. And, you know, until you actually get to that day, you really, quite frankly, are not exactly sure how it's all going to unfold. But I'd say for the most part, you know, we've got a lot of people that help with the operation, and for the most part, I'd say it runs pretty smoothly. You know, you get in a few situations where things happen sort of fast, and, you know, that's just kind of how it goes. Where we are right now exactly with 2 weeks left, really 2 weeks to the day, most of the pro days have been completed to this point. The pro days and most of the individual workouts, which I know those are always of high interest around here. But most of the pro days have been completed. Most of the players have worked out. And in addition, the 30 allotted visits, that time period expires next Wednesday. So that's like the 20th is the last day that you can actually bring a player to your facility for whatever question, whatever the issue may be, whether it's a medical concern, you want to talk to the player a little bit more specifically about football, whatever the case may be. So the 20th, but from the 20th to the 27th, let's say there's a player that you're trying to follow up on that you're not sure of, you need complete verification as to where you stand. Like, for example, player hasn't been in an all-star game, hasn't worked out, really hasn't done anything physically, but he's healthy now, and it's a player you might be interested in to some degree, you can still go down to that school or wherever, or of their hometown and actually work the player out. You can work a player out basically up until the day before the draft. So if there's a situation that comes up, which we've done that in the past, the week of the draft, I forget the year, but I want to say I went down, it was a Wednesday or a Thursday to work a player out before the draft because we were just kind of going through the process, putting the finishing touches on it. We just wanted to make sure we knew exactly what we were talking about. So I went down a few days before, worked the player out, came back. And then really the whole thing, it's a process with the end goal being there's kind of two things. Number one is get it right. I mean, in the end, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get it right. And number two is the sooner the better. I think there are some players where you arrive at your final conclusion or final analysis or your final picture of what the player is, and that's great. The sooner you can do that, then you can move on to the next player. But then maybe there's another player that's in a different situation. You know, just as an example, a few of our players that we've drafted here over the past few years, just use Julian Edelman as an example, okay? Played at Kent State, played quarterback. More than likely, God loved Julian, we all love Julian, but probably wasn't going to play quarterback in the NFL. So, okay, you have to figure out what his position was going to be. And there's been some cases and some examples of players who have made that transition successfully, whether it was Antoine Randall-El. There's been a few cases and a few examples of that. So, didn't go to the combine, wasn't invited to an all-star game, had his pro day workout, and that's essentially it, we may have had a representative there. I'd have to go back and look. So, okay, here's a player who you're projecting to a brand new position. So you really, your information, other than what you've gathered from the fall, from your scouting process, from your scout going into the school, is probably limited. So he was a player that we had sort of earmarked. He was a productive player at his college, at his school. And the one thing we knew about him, he was really good with the ball in his hands. So we went down. We actually worked him out multiple times. We worked him out and as a returner, and then we worked him out as a running back. And then we actually made the decision that his best position was going to be wide receiver. But so no combine, no all-star game, position projection, and that's where the individual workout, I'd say, probably comes into play and is actually paramount. And really, that's all you have to go off of. In addition to what you see in individual workout, then you go off of, when we put together our reports on a player, which we'll talk about there in a minute, but there's different categories. You know, the way we construct the reports, you kind of have your major factors, if you will, that are applicable to all players, their competitiveness, their toughness, their personality / behavior, their athleticism. Then you get into some of the critical factors, which are more specific to their position, and then position skills, for example, with a receiver, his ability to release off the line of scrimmage, what he does with the ball after the catch. So you have that report, and then you make an analysis of what you think that's going to be. Then you get to the workout and say, okay, can he actually do what we think he's going to be able to do? So I would say from an individual workout perspective, I mean, that was a critical part of the process in Julian's case because that's essentially all we had to go off of. Another player that kind of falls into a different category, which just happens a lot, are the non-combine players. There's plenty of good football players that weren't invited to the combine. I can't tell you why they weren't invited to the combine. That's not our responsibility, not our job. So Sebastian Vollmer wasn't invited to the combine. He had played in the All-Star game at the East-West Shrine game, and he actually was a guy who, during the year at Houston, if you were to just evaluate him in the fall, like in September and October, you would say there's some question marks, but he showed a rapid improvement, and then at the East-West game, he actually performed well, and then Dante went down there during the spring, during this whole time period, and worked Sebastian out. And then we made a determination that we felt comfortable with him, and then we made the pick. And you know, I'd say that improvement that Sebastian has made that you saw in college has been consistent to this point with us, and hopefully that will continue moving forward. So there's always players that are at different levels of the process, whether it's the Julian Edelmans of the world, the Sebastian Vollmers, the Rob Gronkowskis, who there's an example of underclassmen, missed an entire year of football. So really, you have to go back to, if you were in the school in 2008, let's say, as a scout, or on the, you went into the school, and that would really be your the only time that you could see Rob Gronkowski live, not knowing he wasn't going to play in 2009. We really weren't sure. Nobody was sure if he was going to actually come out and declare last year, which he ended up doing. So no football in 2009, doesn't do anything at the combine, has no pro day. So as a part of the process, you have your medical evaluation, which we actually met with our doctors today, which they provide their analysis and their input of, okay, here's what the player's malady is. Here's what we think, and they give their prognosis. And then ultimately, we as a staff, Coach Belichick, myself, and the rest of our scouting department have to make a determination whether or not we feel comfortable enough with the player's condition. So we take we take as much input from as many people as possible, whether it's on the medical side, whether it's on the scouting side, whether it's from the coaching staff, and we sort of put all that information together, and you're trying to, in the end, create a profile of a player of what you think that player is going to be, with the whole end game in mind, like we talked about, is to have it right. Now, is it perfect? No. I mean, there's been players who it hasn't worked out, and I'd say that's not uncommon to other, you know, a lot of teams go through that, ourselves included, you know, because I think the hardest part about scouting, especially college players, it's a projection element. I mean, you're talking about the unknown versus when you're dealing with NFL players, at least you can see them against NFL competition. So there's a projection element. We try to allocate as much time and as many resources as we can and hopefully make the decision that we feel is best for the team, and hopefully we have it right. And if we don't, sort of learn why it didn't work and then try not to make that same mistake, you know, moving forward. So I know it's kind of a big picture sort of, you know, a picture of the process at different points. You know, if you guys have any questions just about that, I'm going to talk about this here actually in a minute as it relates to the grading scale, but just with some of the procedural points and some of the different points, if anybody has any thoughts or any questions on that, more than happy to answer them.
Hey, Nick, when you get all the information that you just talked about from the doctors, from the scouts, from your own view on film, and you're trying to get it right, is there a point, though, where something isn't right in some way, but you think it might be worth the gamble? What decides what's worth a gamble, what isn't?
Yeah, in the end, you sort of have to, I don't want to say go with a gut instinct, or you have to go with, maybe there's an example of a player in previous years who is in a similar situation. So you might say, okay, this is what's similar between these two players, or this is what's different. And then in the end, you just have to make a decision that you feel is best for your team, you think is going to work out in your favor. So to answer your question, does it happen? I'd say quite a bit, you know. And in the end, we go with what we think is best based on all the information that we have assembled to that point, and then we go ahead and make the decision. So I'd say there are examples of that. It's not clean cut. You know, you have to sort of go through a process. And even one of the things we do this time of the year actually is, let's say you have a defensive lineman, you know, just Jared Odrick, just to pick a name from last year, you know, and you want to, okay, you're trying to create a picture of that player. Who is he similar to? Okay, let's just say for the sake of the discussion, you know, you think he reminds you of Ty Warren, just as an example, okay? So really what you need to do is go back to Ty Warren at Texas A&M and look at him at that stage relative to Jared Odrick, just as an example, at the same stage at Penn State. Because really, if you try to compare apples to oranges, okay, Odrick's in the NFL, he's done this, you know, or Ty Warren's done this versus Odrick at Penn State, that really doesn't give you a true picture. You want to compare apples to apples as much as you can, and I would say that's something that we spend a fair amount of time doing across positions. This player is similar to such and such from maybe it's a draft 4 or 5 years ago. So you go back and say, okay, here's what he looked like in college. Here's what's similar about that player relative to this player we're talking about this year. Okay, how has that player progressed or how has he performed? Maybe there's something that made it work for him. So I'd say that's one exercise that we go through, and it usually takes place right about this time. Once you're through all the pro days, all the combine, everything else, you can start to really hone in and focus in on some of those specific player comparisons.
Following on that, would you do that with just basically a player on your team, or if you said, okay, Jared Audrick reminds us of, Chris Canty from Dallas, would you look at another team?
If it's a player, let's say you're having a similar discussion, yeah, I think you would, Tom. Okay. You would. And like I said, it really goes back to, you want to do apples to apples. So Chris Canty at Virginia, Jared Audrick at Penn State, Ty Warren at Texas A&M. Okay. If in fact you thought those players were similar, okay, what does that picture look like? So it's just a part of the process, and it's just another component that's used in addition to, okay, here's what the guy did at his respective school, here's what he did at his the All-Star game, here's what he did at the combine, here's what he showed at his pro day, here's what he did at his individual workout. Okay, let's go back. Okay, then you start to do the comparison. So, I mean, for lack of a better analogy, none of us can cook in here. Maybe some of us can cook, but you're like a chef. You're taking all the ingredients, you're trying to put it all together, and you're trying to provide something or come out with something that's good and that's right, and that's the way you see it. So, and that's really what we're trying to do. So, if that makes any sort of sense. One more question, then I'll hit. I want to go through some of this here.
Nick, you mentioned the 30 visits. How about on the private workouts? Can you give a general number on how many times the team will go out and privately work out a player?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put a number on it, and I think in one of your pieces between 100 and 200. I'd say we do a lot. I would say this year has been no different than any other year. With the whole idea of we're just trying to make sure that we have the most accurate picture on the player possible. Because there are things, I'll give you a few examples. So let's say you have an offensive lineman who plays in a pass-oriented system. The guy's always in a two-point stance, which there's been many examples of that. Never in a three-point stance. That's all he is, in the two-point stance, and he's just pass protecting. Okay, so unless you do a workout, or let's say, this is a player you're interested in, you want to say, okay, because the reality is we're not going to sit there and pass protect for 70 snaps a game. I mean, you guys have seen enough NFL games. It just doesn't happen. So, okay, put him in a stance. Can he bend his knees? Does he have some initial quickness? Does he have some power in his hips? With the idea being, okay, how is that going to translate over to the running game? So it's going to be hard to see that on tape. So until you put them in a one-on-one type setting in an individual workout and make that determination, then you're not going to know. So you're better off going down there, finding out the answer for sure, and then you say, okay, yes, he can do it, or you know what, I'm not so sure. The other example is with running backs, which I would say most backs in college, they're carrying the football. They're runners. Very few backs are involved in the passing game. So their production, by and large, let's say 15 to 25 receptions on average. I mean, now there's, if you drew a bell curve, there's going to be extremes on either side where a guy catches 60 balls or, whatever the case may be. So, okay, he's not really involved in the passing game, or what they do, he runs from me to you and just turns and looks at the quarterback. Okay, well, unless he goes to an all-star game where the route running is a little bit more extensive, or even at the combine, okay, he does a few drills, he catches a few balls. Okay, how good are his hands? Is he going to be able to catch the ball? What kind of a route runner is he? Does he have some quickness and some maneuverability where he can set up a route? Okay. How about pass protection? Because our running backs, they're going to have to block. I mean, if we play the Jets, we better be prepared to pass protect. So can that a running back, can he process information, number one? Can he handle all the multiples that are involved in protection? Can he actually stand in there and play with some strength and hold up in pass protection, which, I mean, Kevin Faulk is probably one of the best pass protectors that we have on our team. You look at him, he's 5'7", 200 pounds, but he understands leverage, he can bend his knees, he can play with his hands, and that's something that can be taught and that can be trained. So with a running back, you say, okay, here's what I saw. He catches the ball. I don't have any questions about his hands. He's strong through his hips. He can learn. You'd like to think that you can be able to improve that over the course of from year one to year two. So those are just two examples, and that could apply to a number of different positions. And I would say that is the benefit of doing an individual workout. Is there value in going to the pro day? Sure, but some of these, I mean, you guys have probably even attended some of these pro days. There's 500 people, the NFL Network's there. I mean, ESPN3 is there. I mean, so how much can you actually get done? I mean, it's difficult. So I think however we can do it, well, if it's at a pro day and we have to do it, great. One part of the pro day, I think that does come in handy is the night before. I mean, there's plenty of time there. You can go in, you can sit down. We can sit down, we can put on the tape, we can watch tape for an hour and a half with the player unimpeded and see what he knows. I'd say that's part of the process as well. You know, which in a pro day, if you just go to watch the guy work out, probably be tough to do. So, I mean, every team does it. You know, I would say the number of workouts that we've done has been no different than we've done in the past. So whatever that number is, then that's what it is. So before we get going to the next question, I just want to kind of explain this here. So they just basically took the card, and this is actually very similar to the card that we'll use on our draft board. So the player's name, which Brian had the, you know, a very ingenious idea of Willie Score, so it must be a running back, a pretty big running back, I'd say. So, but the name, the position, and his height and weight. So the V is telling you that's a verified height. Now that usually doesn't come until either the Senior Bowl measurement, or an All-Star game measurement, or from the combine. In reality, as a player, he might be measured 4-6 times during the course of a spring. Now, is he always going to be 6'3 and a half? He might be off by a half an inch. Who knows? Some of the combine measurements, I mean, guy measured half inch shorter, then he goes to his pro day, he's a half inch taller. Well, unless he put lifts in his feet, which you can't measure with your shoes, then all of a sudden he grew in the 4-week span. But you get a verified height, verified weight, and then that time is an estimated time. The verified time will come at the combine. So you have your time, and then the A1 is the surface. So there's multiple surfaces that the player will run on. It could be field turf, it can be AstroTurf, it could be natural grass. So we have a code for each of those particular surfaces so we know what the guy ran on. Like you might know, say, okay, this is a historically fast track. So you sort of factor that into the equation. The Wunderlich score, and then their birth date is on a card. And then their respective school, which are all coded. So for however many colleges there are, we use a 4-letter code to denote what that school is. So for example, Cincinnati is OHCI, I believe. Ohio State is OHST. So we have a code essentially for, I would say, just about every school that's out there, even a smaller school or whatever it may be. This here, the ZS49LW, is the player's grade. So what that essentially means is any letter before the number is what we call the typing. And what that indicates is the player's is either height, weight, speed. So if he's an I player, it means he's height, weight, speed, clean, based on the standards that we have in our system, okay? In this particular example, the player is a Z, which means he's height deficient. Now, does that knock a player out? Does it really mean anything? No, it means, okay, it's a little bit less than what our standard is, but it's just there as just a typing so we know how tall he is or just kind of where he fits relative to another player. An S is just a speed deficient player. If there was a B in there, it'd be bulk deficient based on his weight. So there's a height, weight, a speed. So that's our typing on the player, and that just is talking about just his height, weight, speed relative to the standard for his position. This is the grade 49. We actually only go to, we use two basically spots. He's a 49, a 65. You know, that comes off of the card, which I don't even know what some of those decimals mean, but it's usually two numbers that we use. Just on a grading scale, just generally speaking, it goes from 1 to 9, with 1 being not very good to 9 being this guy's rare at that particular skill. So when you write your report, there should be some correlation between all those factor grades, your final grade, and then the player game grade that you assign to that player. Like you go see the guy play, Rutgers plays North Carolina. So in that game, Devin McCourty played a 6 game, or he played a 5 game. So, but there should be some correlation between all those numbers and what their final grade is. And then the alert system, that's what these letters designate. So there's alerts for a number of different things. These two examples right here, this is an L is lower level of competition. So for example, a player from Lehigh, just to pick a name. So it's 1AA, it's a lower level of competition. There's plenty of players that have come from that level and been successful and productive, but it's just an alert so we know that, okay, you play against a lower level of comp, so that means when I'm watching this player, you want to see him against the best player possible. Now, maybe that's not going to come until an All-Star game, or maybe one of their opponents has a tackle who's projected to be a draft pick. But it just tells you, okay, it's a lower level comp. We just want to see him against good people. And then W in this example is just a weight alert. Either the player has a weight problem, he's maybe a little too heavy, maybe he's even too light. And let's say you have just a 200-pound linebacker or something that is well short of your standard. So it can go both ways, too high, too low on the weight. So really, it's just an alert. It doesn't eliminate a player. It just tells us, okay, there's something that we need to investigate a little bit further. So that's why every grade's not going to be the same. Like if you were to just list all those players that are up on the board and just have all their grade with no alerts, I mean, you know, we're not even sure what you're even talking about. So it's a way for us to sort of classify players so you can say, okay, look, I want to see all the bulk deficient players, or I want to see all the lower level competition players. You can run a query in our computer system and just pull up a list of all those players and see who they are. So that's the way that the grading scale is sort of put together and constructed. So I don't know how we're doing on time here, but a few more minutes probably. Questions?
Nick, what's the difference between it being just an alert and the, you know, capital letters, the height or speed deficient?
It's just the typing, just on a, it's just this, the uppercase letters are the typing, the lowercase letters are the alert. So that's all it really means. So I mean, you know, you could have a lower S, but it's just a way for us sort of to distinguish the typing, you know, and then which the all is all the height, weight, speed measurables, and then the alerts, whatever those may be.
So would it be more damning if he had a B in there as opposed to a W? Or
depends. Yeah. It, like I said, it doesn't necessarily eliminate a player. It just sort of alerts you to, okay, he's not a clean player. Like he's a little short. Like Kevin Falk would be, for his position, you know, would be a Z, you know, because he's just tight deficient. Does that eliminate him as a player? No. Barry Sanders would be a Z also, and he's one of the, you know, better back. Darren Sproles, I mean, those guys would be Z's. Leon Washington. I mean, there's enough examples of good football players. So Maurice Jones-Drew, he might have been a double Z because he was really short from a height perspective, but he's built like a house. So it doesn't eliminate a player. It just tells you, like, you know, just sort of what we're even talking about here size-wise.
And how do you, that standard, you said, you know, the standard, obviously, that is that something you guys set?
It's something that we established. Each position has a height, weight, speed standard that we use, which it's sort of evolving. You know, it's sort of been in place. But, you know, what we found kind of in some of our research is that, I want to say it doesn't necessarily apply, but maybe you have a standard deviation of 0.5 either way. So maybe you want to adjust it to be more reflective of what's playing in the league, and then also what's on our team. So how that measures up.
How many players each year do you compile information on?
Oh boy. Well, we try to. The best way I can answer that is in the spring. So you just saw the clip of the 2010 draft, I believe that was. So we started compiling information on those players in the spring of 2009. We put together a spring prospectus, and what we do is, we get information from the school, and they say, okay, here are our A, B, C prospects. And then the area scout that is assigned to that particular school, he goes through, and he'll watch the A's and B's for sure for the spring purpose. He'll also watch the C prospects. But then when he goes back to the school in the fall, any senior starter is going to get an evaluation and a report. So, I mean, we're probably talking over thousands of players. Now, you sort of have to minimize that. And in our first round of meetings in December, you try to put together some facsimile of a board like you see there, but that list of names is certainly much less than everybody that you've scouted, you know, because you have to start to put them into a particular grade classification and start to group players. And I would say that's when the first vertical stacking of the board starts to take place, is even in the spring. After we do our spring book, we'll say, okay, the players ranked top, you know, high to low, and we'll put them up there. Like, for example, the quarterbacks on this board, they'll be put on the board high to low at their respective grade levels. And they're not all just sort of lumped together like that. There's spacing. Like, one guy might be a 7-0. Next guy is a 68, so, and on down the line. So you start to stack them in the spring, and then as you go through December, which is our first round of draft meetings, into February, you continually move the players. But it's a vast number of players that you start with.
How many people in the organization are involved?
Quite a few. The, you know, our scouting staff, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 of us. You know, our college director, John Robinson, he handles sort of the college side of it and does an outstanding job of organizing that. And then we have our our scouts, our area scouts, and we have over-the-top type scouts or regional scouts, if you will. And then even our pro scouting department, which Jason Light heads up, they're involved in the process as well. So there's a number of people that are involved in the process. And you know, I'll just selfishly, we're pretty fortunate. We have a great group in this organization, and I personally enjoy working with on a day-to-day basis.
Nick, when you look at players, use Gronkowski maybe as an example, is there a point that he has to hit before you'll consider him as a guy you'll draft? There's guys in this draft, for instance, who have been coming up with some medical issues. Move that guy down and then say the value.
It's a good point, Tom. One of the things that we talk about is grade the player for what he is. Evaluate the player, assign the grade, and that's where the alerts and the typings come into play. So you evaluate the player, you assign the grade based on what he can do on the field. You know, for example, let's say a guy, you don't want to double grade a player. Okay, he's a good player, but, okay, my source at the school dislikes the player, is not a big fan, says he's a questionable character guy. You sort of have to remove yourself. I'm not saying it's not a part of the report, an important part of the process, but you indicate that in your report, put the alert on the player, assign the grade, and then we'll go through the process of what that player's value is. But the most important thing is grade the player for what he is as a player, use the typings and the alerts, which is why we have the system in place, and then go from there.
Okay.
One more, Stace, maybe? One or two more?
I promised that I would get this in 30 minutes or so it's already been over 30 minutes.
I'm supposed to meet with Coach Belichick, so I'll be thrilled.
Is this system similar around the league, this type of thing? Does every team have their own?
I think every team has their own system. You know, this system was in place before I arrived here. You know, when Scott and Bill came in 2000, this is the system that they put in place. So there may be some facsimiles of this throughout the league. I can't speak to other teams. I know this is the way that we do it, and you know, I'm not sure how other teams do it, but there's probably some degree of similarities across the league.
Does everyone fill out the cards, or is it you? Or
it's actually computer-generated, Karen. So you kind of sync to the database, and once that information is linked to the system, and we just print a card, and you know, the card comes out, and we put it in there. And as far as stacking the cards, there are a lot of people that are, and like John Robinson, I would say, you know, he has somebody that helps him, but it's all based on the grade. So, like, here are the 67s, you could print the cards and put them at the 67 level. So it's all based on wherever the player is graded, and then we'll just put the card up there on the board.
And then, Nick, with the situation this year, with the lockout, the fact that you can draft the player, but then you can't indoctrinate him to your system, you can't give a playbook, is there a different kind of evaluation system to know that your window with him is going to shrink in terms of getting impact out of him for hopefully for next year? You're not going to have him that long. Are you going to try to evaluate different things in terms of his acumen to pick up your system? Or you know, is there a different kind of evaluation because of the situation you're in? It's so different.
Right. I would say our approach this year is no different than it's been in years past. You know, we're looking for the players that can improve our football team the most, and then that's what we're focused on doing. So we're evaluating the player for his skill set based on the information that we've gathered, and then we'll move forward from there. So our approach hasn't really changed much at all.
Yeah, one of the things I just want to, you mentioned that you guys are, you know, evaluating the standards for different positions. I think there's sort of a perception out there that your standards, maybe say for outside linebacker, differ from a lot of what's in the league. That position specifically, have you guys gone back and looked at what's in the league, what your standards are, and maybe adjusted that somewhat?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're always looking at different things. You know, in terms of the players and the types of players and the standards, I mean, it's no different. I mean, the most important thing is finding good football players that can help our football team, whatever shape and form they come in. I mean, Danny Woodhead's a perfect example. I would say he falls short in some of the quote-unquote standards. But so, I mean, that's something that we're always evaluating across positions, the different standards and where we are relative to the rest of the league. You know, I would say just that position, I mean, there's more and more teams that are looking for similar type players. And in college, you know, the pool of players maybe isn't as big to begin with. So, I mean, everybody's looking at the same players, and ultimately you just have to make the decision that you feel is best for your team.
Would you evaluate, say, a Clay Matthews or a Lamar Woodley? Would you grade them differently now than you would have then?
No, I think we would grade the player, you know, and we like both of those players. I mean, we would evaluate them the same way and grade the player the same way. So, all right, thanks a bunch. Appreciate it. Yep, you got it.